Welcome back to the Medical Illustration Podcast. This is your host, Paul Kelly. I make surgical teaching videos at the Toronto Video Atlas of Surgery, which suits me particularly well because in addition to my fascination with the inner workings of the human body and making visual media of various kinds, I also love to document things. This love of documenting has carried over into the podcast you're now listening to. I love podcasts, and I want to document the stories of people who make medical illustrations and visual media for science, biology, and healthcare using the audio medium of podcasting. In this episode, I'm going to invite my listeners into the world of medical illustration within the medical education and healthcare context. This is the niche within the field that I work in, where the target audience is often doctors, medical students, researchers, and patients and their families. Someone whose work I've been following in this space and who I've gotten to know a bit through the Association of Medical Illustrators is today's guest. Anthony Baker is a board-certified medical illustrator in Columbus, Ohio. Since 2008, he has directed the Ohio State University's medical visuals team, creating visuals for the Ohio State Health Sciences faculty, physicians, and researchers. Before joining OSU, he illustrated for the University of Cincinnati Department of Neurosurgery, Mayfield Clinic, and Nationwide Children's Hospital. He has created illustrations for various medical textbooks, including the Atlas of Operative Microneurosurgery, Volume 2, by Tu and Van Lovren, which won an AMI Illustrated Book Award, and the Zollinger Atlas of Surgical Operations, 11th edition. Anthony graduated from the Columbus College of Art and Design with a BFA in Illustration in 1986, and he earned his medical illustration degree from the Ohio State University in 1991. Anthony is an active professional member of the Association of Medical Illustrators and a member of the European Association of Medical and Scientific Illustrators. At the 2021 AMI virtual meeting, Anthony gave presentations about robotic surgery and his involvement with the Zollinger Atlas. He has worked on various AMI committees and served as an annual meeting salon judge. Drawing is his happy place. When he is not at work, he likes to spend his time drawing and painting. Please enjoy this interview with Anthony Baker. Thank you so much for doing this and for taking the time. I really appreciate it. You've been someone I've really been interested to chat with because I think we have some similar experience with the field of medical illustration, working in like academic settings with researchers. I work with a lot of surgeons. I know you've worked with a lot of surgeons. You've done a lot of surgical illustration pieces and stuff. So I've really wanted to pick your brain, you know, kind of on your experience, and you've been in the field quite a bit longer than I have. So definitely, you know, a lot more experience there that you can share. So why don't we just kind of start off with where your journey began? I was wondering if maybe you could just start us off with what got you involved with art in the very beginning.
Oh, sure. That's a great question. My dad was an artist. He became an engineer, a civil engineer, but he always had a passion, still does, for drawing and painting. So I learned a lot from him. We lived in San Diego, and he would take me drawing in the park, in Balboa Park, and we'd just sit and draw, and he would give me little bits of information to help me. Like he'd always say, light against dark. You know, you want to make sure you have the contrast. And I learned a lot about form and shape and technique and just a love of drawing from him. So that's how it started. I come from a long line of engineers. I didn't go into engineering. I'd rather the curvy biological line to the straight edge, you know, to the straight line. But his dad was an engineer. And before them, there's a long line of people in the arts in my family. So it seemed like a natural thing to do. When I was a kid, though, high school, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into performing arts or visual arts. I liked to be in plays and musicals, and it was sort of a tear between those two directions. So I ended up going to art school. I spent a year in California going to San Diego State and UCSD, and then I came back to Ohio where we had moved, and attended the Columbus College of Art and Design, graduated from CCAD in 1986. While there, I didn't learn anything at all about medical illustration. They didn't teach it. There was no introduction to it. It wasn't until a couple years later when I met a medical illustrator by chance at a job I was doing that I became interested in the field. I did, while in art school, have a professor, a figure drawing teacher, who, when he was teaching us and while we were doing figure drawing exercises, he would talk a lot about what's under the surface. He'd say, you know, this bump is caused by this muscle underneath, or this protrusion is because there's this bone here. And he talked about the structure underneath. So that was my first introduction to, you know, what's under the surface and how that was really interesting. He would have us do a figure drawing or go to the museum and copy a portrait and then put tissue overlays over that drawing and then sketch out where the bone is, where the orbits are, where the mandible is, and sometimes the muscles as well. So he taught us to think about what's under the surface. But then later when I met a medical illustrator and I thought it was super interesting, I also learned that there was at that time a medical illustration program here at Ohio State. It's since closed down. It closed down in the mid-90s. But I, after graduating from CCAD and working for a short time, enrolled in the program here at Ohio State and graduated in 91. And I've been doing this ever since, except for a year we took off to go teach English in China. But otherwise, you know, like since 91, 2001, 2011, 2021, that's like over 30 years doing this. And I've loved it. Like, it's been the best thing for me.
That's awesome. Now, I have to ask, because you mentioned the engineering connection you have with your family there. Did you ever take any technical drawing courses or anything like that for, like, you know, machine part, stuff like that?
There were some similar courses at CCAD that were part of the illustration degree that we took, perspective drawing, technical drawing. The difference I found in studying medical illustration was that in medical illustration education, the focus is very much on representing the thing. You know, how do you know, you learn the basics of form highlight, reflected highlight, form shadow, cast shadow. It was a lot more precise in medical illustration school than it was in art school. So I really think it was a nice mix of the two, the artistic education and the more technical illustration of medical illustration school was a nice combination for me.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to hear more about your training experience when you got started, because, like, as you mentioned, back in the 90s. So you guys were working in traditional quite a bit more.
Oh, yeah. Entirely traditional. No computers. No computers. In fact, I didn't start working on a computer until my first job at Mayfield Clinic and Department of Neurosurgery at University of Cincinnati, which was 94 to 97. That's when I first started using a computer. And I think we were using, well, of course, Illustrator and Photoshop, early versions. And not PageMaker. What was after PageMaker? Quark Express. Yeah, that's going way back. But it was all on the job learning. That was it. All the training in medical illustration was all traditional. Carbon dust. One of the my favorite things I ever did was this carbon dust skull. Actually, I have it on the wall behind me. I loved carbon dust. Of course, you know, it's not a practical technique anymore because of how long it takes. But I really enjoyed carbon dust and pen and ink and traditional color, things like that. Steve Moon was our instructor. He was in charge of the program. And he studied under Gerald Hodge at University of Michigan. And Gerald Hodge had studied under Renice Crosby, I think, who had been a student of Bradel's. I might be missing a generation or two, but it was nice to be able to trace the line back to Max Bradel as far as training, you know. Yeah, I loved all that because, you know, drawing is my thing. So people say that they come to medical illustration either from the science side or the art side. If you're coming in from the science side, you've got a really strong science foundation. You have to build up your art classes and your art skills. But if you're coming in through the art door, you know, it's the opposite. You might be strong in art, but you need to build up your science. And that was my course. I've always struggled with grasping the science. I always have to try harder to do that because it didn't come naturally and still doesn't come naturally. It's still kind of an effort. I don't know if you find that to be true, that...
Oh, yeah. Nope. That's actually quite similar to my background, too. So my undergrad was in kinesiology. So I did have a little bit of exposure to it, but I would say that my experience was more so that I had a bit of a stronger art background. And then I had to really kind of push myself more to pick up the science. For folks who have that situation, what recommendations would you have for them to help them get into the science and study it and learn it and get better at absorbing it?
Yeah, talk about it. Talk to somebody. I find talking about the journal article I'm reading or the anatomy text, talking about it with somebody, anybody, where you're kind of teaching it to them, you're telling them what you're learning, that helps me a lot. If I'm just reading it, maybe it gets in there, I'm not sure. But if I'm talking about it with somebody and I'm using my own words to form the concept, that really helps me grasp it a lot better. So I'd say verbalize it.
That's great. I like that. That really makes sense. Yeah.
And thinking back too, I mirror that as well, because the things I know the best are the things that I've discussed the most with like family members or friends. You know, they're interested in that topic. They're like, wait, so how does that work? And wait a minute, don't they have to do this? And
yeah,
they'll throw out things out of left field that you did not think to ask or look at.
Yeah. And then you can go back and kind of, you know, find the answers to those questions. Yeah. Yeah. When you're starting to talk about it, you realize what you don't know. Like, and you don't realize you don't know it until you talk about it. Like, I'll be trying to explain something and then I'll get to a point where, gee, I don't really know what to say next. And that reveals an area that I need to go back and learn more.
Yeah. Now, when you mentioned you went off to China, you had mm-hmm. taught English for a year. And then when you came back, tell us a little bit about that transition, because I know that that's sometimes an option for folks to maybe, you know, take a year off, or they want to do, you know, some traveling before they really get into the job. So can you talk a little bit about how that contributed? Like, what were the logistics like to kind of work through all that? And then what were the benefits? What were the drawbacks? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. So I graduated in 91 from medical illustration school and was recently married with our first son. So a lot happened when I started medical illustration school. I got married, had a kid, and
so you were, hold on, wait. So you were in school when you had your first son?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh uh-huh. My God, dude, I can't imagine doing that. I got my first one now. I can't.
Yeah, congratulations.
I can't imagine doing school at the same time. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. My wife is really the trooper there, because she had graduated and she was working and being pregnant and worked right up until the day that she delivered. So like, without her, it wouldn't have been possible. I mean, like, in so many ways. That's a silly thing to say. But yeah, like, so it was a team effort. But that's how I was able to, you know, go back to school and get the degree. So, you know, there were reasons why staying in Columbus was the thing I needed to do, because married with child and other responsibilities that kept me here. But yeah, it was a lot to manage all at once. But we went to China, taught English, came back, and had our second child. And so I did freelance work. I just grabbed whatever freelance work I could do from my small basement studio in our apartment. And then a year or so after that, got the job at Mayfield Clinic. And so we packed up everything and moved to Cincinnati, and was there for 3 years. The interesting thing about leaving the country and coming back is that I really felt like an immigrant. Like, I really felt like starting over, you know, like when you move to a new country and you have nothing or very little and you don't know people and you're finding a place to live and you're getting the stuff of your life together, it was different. It's an experience that you can't get any other way, really, you know. Yeah, it's just different.
I would say probably increases your empathy a lot too, right?
Totally does. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was one thing that really surprised me, actually, moving to Canada, is the little cultural differences I do notice and like did not anticipate. And you have to like give people the benefit of the doubt a little bit more, be a little bit more patient with people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing.
They're doing an amazing thing. It's so hard to move to another country. They should be given a higher level of respect than often they get in some communities. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And if there's a new language. I mean, it wasn't quite the same for me, because I was coming back to my country, although I had gone to a different country. So I experienced what it was like to be a foreigner in a strange land, so a little bit. But yeah, and then coming back to my own country, I wasn't learning a new language and I knew how things functioned. It was just a more matter of setting up all the stuff of life again, all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll have to forgive me, because in one of the questions I had sent you, I had thought you were teaching at Ohio State, and I apologize.
Oh, no problem.
You're not actually like a teacher there, but I think it's because of the impression I have of you with your posts. You look like a teacher. I mean, you project this energy of someone who can teach and who has a, you know, a professor's level of knowledge and mastery over your craft. In particular, you had done this workshop recently about teaching folks on how to draw a heart exercise. And I love this idea of presenting just one illustration. Here's a concept, and here's, I'm going to teach you a system for drawing this that is a repeatable, strategic way of approaching this subject. So can you tell us a little bit about this workshop and how this came together?
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I've always been interested in helping health sciences students with some drawing skills. I think it would really benefit them in the learning of anatomy and in physiology and other topics, and help them if they become teachers or if they become doctors and are instructing patients, help them with some tools that they can use to explain concepts to whoever their audience is. And so I was asked by this group here at Ohio State called Humanism in Medicine. It's a sort of an art group for OSU health sciences and medical students. It tries to get them to explore the arts as well as their medical training. And so they asked me if I would teach a workshop to them about how to draw something. So it was a perfect opportunity to explore this idea of teaching students some basic drawing concepts. So I came up with this very simple way of drawing a heart, sort of from an anterior lateral view, just using lines and shapes. And so I put together the materials, like I printed off little protractors and rulers and gave them pencils and tissue paper. And I created this worksheet that takes them step by step. And then I demonstrated it and they followed along. It was really a good experience. But everyone knows how to make lines and mark off lengths and draw angles with a protractor. This is, you know, like starting with that, with a point, drawing a horizontal and a vertical, and then a 40 degree line at an angle, using a couple of other points as points to draw other lines. And then that's the framework, and you make a series of shapes. And then once you have this framework, on the next overlay, you draw, you know, you kind of connect them and you draw the form, and you have to do some curves and things. But it's trying to just teach them basic concepts about proportion and shapes and seeing shapes in everything. It's really simple. And for us, it's like, you know, duh. But for someone who has never really drawn, it can really help, I think. So since then, I have partnered with the Department of Anatomy, who often brings in groups of health sciences students, undergraduate students, high school students, to introduce them to the anatomy lab and to cadavers and to anatomy-related careers. So like when they're in the cadaver lab, or where if they're here in the anatomy visualization suite doing some VR, I'll take a group aside and teach them this exercise. So they get to see the real thing in the lab. They get to experience a virtual reality version of anatomy, and they get to try doing some drawing as a way of capturing all the concepts of how anatomical structures look and function. So we're hoping to gather some data around this as we do more groups, and then write a paper about it, and hopefully love to present it at an AMI meeting sometime.
That sounds really awesome.
I've heard other people talk about how medical illustrators can help medical students and doctors with drawing skills, some basic fundamental drawing skills. And at the meeting last year, Jill Gregory encouraged us all to kind of connect with other departments in institutions, and especially departments of anatomy. So I was hoping to find some way to work with them. So it's worked out really well.
That's really cool. Yeah, I would love to see the publication when you guys put that together, because I think that is where we're starting to see more people interested in this exact kind of thing. I think there's more interest in that area of starting to publish papers, like really look at evaluating the way that we make our work, and is it effective? Does it have the intended consequences, right?
Yeah, that's really good. In fact, kind of on that subject, I really like that list that you put together on the AMI hub of all the different articles and resources for learning more about the effectiveness of medical illustration in journal publishing and in other areas. And also Professor Jenkinson.
Yeah, Jody Jenkinson.
Jody Jenkinson's lab in Toronto is a great resource too. I just started digging into that recently for like a lot of ways, like to help us think outside the box of how to visualize things and how new ways to present things visually to teach people.
Thank you for that. I am actually way overdue to update that list. But yeah, it was a good starting point. And at the time when I was looking up stuff, I was like surprised that there wasn't more out there. And one thing I would like to look a lot more for is, I know there's been eye tracking studies for video to see like where people look as they're going through an educational video. I would like to see more of those. And the similar thing, I wonder if anyone's tried that for illustration work. I think with tracking video, they could probably set up like a camera right in front of it, but it would be interesting to see if someone has done something similar for still images.
That would be very interesting, because it's kind of in our minds too when we're composing a figure, right? We think about where the focus, where we intend the focus to be. We want the viewer to look at this thing first and this thing second, or follow this flow. And so testing it to see if the way we're thinking is actually what they're doing would be really effective.
And the most common question that I get from people, you know, who are interested in becoming a medical illustrator is, you know, something sort of along the lines of, do I really need to go to school for this? I think you kind of have to. I mean, that everything you were just describing about teaching these fundamentals of light on form and proportion, measurement, a lot of these things, and especially for our field, I feel like you would have to have some kind of crash course in bringing all these different components together, that the art, the science, and the business, right, and the tech. So, I mean, I think I would strongly encourage people to pursue it, but what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I agree with you that I think we need training in medical illustration to do it effectively. So I agree with you. Then that opens up the door to, well, what sort of training? Only graduate level training, or are other ways possible? I would suggest other ways are possible. We have the certification vehicle to test people's competency in medical illustration, and that's a way to safeguard the quality of the work we do. But I think there are talented people who may not have access to graduate level education. Like, there is no way I could leave Columbus and go to Johns Hopkins or Chicago for graduate school. Like, I just, that wasn't possible for me. But does that mean that I shouldn't have had the opportunity to become a medical illustrator? I would say no. That I was grateful for the OSU program. It was not a graduate level program, but it trained me well. And I think that there are many roads to becoming a successful medical illustrator.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
And I think we should also, I'm really glad you made that distinction, because I slip up a lot, and I should make that statement now very clear that I don't think or argue that the master's programs are necessary. I just think some level of training is, you know, a good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
And there are, man, I have definitely seen some incredibly talented, hardworking, intelligent folks be able to enter the field without going through like a formal training. It is 100% possible. It's just a very much an uphill battle.
It is. It is. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are definite benefits to the graduate level education. I can see that clearly. Yes. Yeah, some education is necessary.
And I also think that what we will probably see more in the AMI, because I would personally like to push for this more, is to emphasize the work of the undergraduate programs a bit more. Mm-hmm. And put that, because the folks who come out of those programs, they look completely legit, you know, like really good folks. And I think they fit in just at any studio. I almost feel like the one thing that the master's programs have that the undergrad don't are the master's research projects. I could be wrong about that, but I think just that deep dive into like one specific topic for an extended period of time, and you kind of create like a whole thing just off of like this one topic. I feel like that is kind of like a grad level thing, and maybe the cadaver dissection, that might be something else too. But either way, you know, it's just sort of the idea of immersing yourself, right, in the training, mm-hmm. and exposing and connecting with these professors who are, you know, going to be able to open all kinds of doors for you, both academically. They're going to be able to introduce you to people. They're going to tell you about folks you didn't know that, like, oh, there's this amazing person doing this research here. Like, you should, you know, contact this person. Oh, you're into this topic, you should talk to this person. You know, like, they're just amazing nexuses of all this, you know, knowledge and activity, right?
Yeah, absolutely agree. Yep.
Yeah. But
I remember what I was going to say. You have to work harder. If you aren't going through an established program, you just have to work harder to get to that level. You can do it, but you have to work a lot harder. Take advantage of other opportunities, put in more time, practice, network, read, study, learn more, you know, to reach the level that you get from one of the programs.
Yeah, I agree. So now this is a good segue to talk a little bit about when you first started getting out there working, because, you know, I think that that's probably what a lot of the folks who want to jump right into work and, you know, bypass school, that's kind of what they're eager for, right? They're hungry. They want to just get out there, get work, start making money. Can't blame anybody for that.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your work experience when you first started working and you're like, I'm in it now. I'm doing it. I'm doing the thing. You know, what was your first job like? What tools were you using?
Yeah, sure. So I went to school with Tanya Hines, and she was a year ahead of me. So when I came back from China and I was looking for jobs, she mentioned that they were hiring at the Mayfield Neurological Institute at the University of Cincinnati. David Reaney had gone there to start a department because the neurosurgeons there, especially the chairman, Dr. Tu, was writing an atlas for Saunders, I think, on his micro neurosurgical techniques. He and Dr. Van Loveren were co-authoring it, and they hired David Reaney to illustrate the book. And that one assignment had turned into the creation of a whole department, which I've seen happen so many times. Like, a doctor hires an illustrator to work on a project and then realizes how essential that illustrator is and has them illustrate other things. And then the department grows. And then that illustrator is also putting together the doctor's slide presentations, and they become an invaluable resource for that department. And that's what had happened there. And so David had hired Tanya to be his backup, his assistant, on the Atlas and other things. And then David left to go to Johns Hopkins, where he's now teaching in the medical illustration program there. And Tanya was looking for an assistant, so she hired me, and I moved there. And that was such a cool job. I loved it so much because we would, in the morning, go into the operating room and watch a brain surgery, and sketch and take pictures. And they were taking videotape through their scope camera. And then we go back to our studio because we actually had a little room, one room studio that was connected to the dissection lab, because they had a head dissection lab, which was another cool space, because then you could take heads out of buckets and put them on the Mayfield head holder and try out the technique or procedure and see the actual thing. Like, nothing's better than seeing the actual specimen of what you're drawing. So I got to work on that atlas. It was volume 2 of the Atlas of Operative Microneurosurgery. And we had a very interesting high-tech technique for creating the final illustrations. David has this beautiful style of pencil on like a cold press paper with beautiful gray tones. He's a master, and it's just beautiful. And the style he had created for this atlas was great. So the finals were done in pencil. A mechanical pencil, really, very fine lit. And we would, of course, sketch out each step of the procedure on tracing paper. And then we would put that tracing paper in backwards on the copier, on this regular Xerox copier, and start to make a copy. And as it got to a certain spot, we'd stop the copier by opening the front door of the copier before that paper would pass through the fuser unit, so that you have the dusting of the line in black and white on the paper, but it hasn't been fused to the paper yet, so that you could take the paper out of the copier, put it face down on your final piece of cold press Bristol, and kind of rub on the back of it, and would transfer that as a line drawing on your paper. Like, that's what, wow, I mean, it's really, really high tech technique we did.
That's awesome.
And then, you know, then we trace over those lines and we'd start the shading process for the steps. But it was a great first job because Tanya was amazing. Like, I don't know, have you ever seen the movie Devil Wears Prada?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So you know how Stanley Tucci is Meryl Streep's right-hand man, and he can read her mind. He finishes her sentences, and he's essential to her. Well, Tanya was like this for Dr. Tu, the chairman of the department. Like, he relied on her for putting together his slide presentations, and like, she knew what he was going to ask for before he would come in the door for a meeting. Like, she, right. It was in awe of their working relationship and how sharp she is. And I think that's what I remember. One of the things I remember the most that really impressed me is how a medical illustrator can become so essential to surgeons or other medical professionals that they really rely on them a lot.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it many times, and I think that's the story of many great atlases, is this working collaboration between the illustrator and the clinician, right? I mean, we've seen it many times over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And now you've done a lot of recent work in robotic surgery, which is an emerging subspecialty. I'd love to hear more about what you've been doing there and your experience with it.
Yeah. So another book is the Zollinger Atlas of Surgical Operations, which was started by Robert Zollinger back in the, well, Robert Zollinger and Dr. Elliot Carr Cutler back in the 30s, a surgical atlas for non-surgeons, like family doctors, country doctors who would have to perform appendectomies and things like that. And it's grown over the years into a really thick book through 7 editions. And, you know, each time they revise it, they take out the procedures that aren't done anymore. They add new procedures. And it's been illustrated by lots of people, including Mildred Cotting, who was a student of Max Bradel, Carol Donner, and others. And I got to illustrate the most recent edition, where they had 14 new chapters, and many of them were about robotic surgery, you know, because it's a, as you said, it's an emerging thing, and they wanted to include that in this version of the Atlas. So I got to learn about robotic surgery, which I didn't know anything about before. And I was fascinated by the equipment and the positioning in the operating room, where the surgeon is kind of remote and over here, and they have their hands on these controls that look like sort of like high-tech video controls, and they're looking at this screen, but they're affecting this whole network of arms that are reaching down over the patient and holding long. It's a lot like laparoscopic surgery, but it's, you know, connected to these robotic arms. And there's a team of
like next level.
Yeah.
Laparoscopic. Yeah.
Yeah. So they really could be anywhere doing this. The robotic arms can do things that a surgeon couldn't do if it was an open procedure and their hands were in the patient's body. They can, there are fine, subtle movements. There are ways of twisting the instruments that they couldn't do otherwise. And in illustrating those procedures, one of the big differences I noticed, which is, I guess, also similar to laparoscopic surgery, is that the surgeon's view is not looking down over the patient. The surgeon's view is looking on a screen, and the camera is passing through a tube, coming in kind of like if you're flying a plane and you were about to land on the runway. You know, it's like it's not a top-down view. It's more like coming in from the side. So the anatomy is different. So I had to think about, and of course there was video to help, but I had to think about how the anatomy would be different from that view. And that was an interesting challenge. Another challenge is representing the instruments. They're very detailed and they're different from other traditional instruments. But how much do you represent them? Like how detailed do you make them? Enough so that you know the viewer knows that they're robotic instruments, but not so much that they take away from the overall, you know, image that you're trying to draw. So I learned a lot, and also there's this one where this abdominal hernia repair that they do, where they flip the camera upside down so that like when they're peeling off these layers internally so they can see it in a certain way. And so how do you draw that when it, to communicate that the camera's upside down? Anyway, there are crazy things. There are lots of challenges with it, but I learned a lot.
That is so cool. Yeah. And what you're describing there too is such a great case for the value of what a medical illustrator is bringing to the table, because mm-hmm. you're manipulating anatomy in a completely unfamiliar perspective. You've got to figure out a way to communicate not only what's happening to your audience with this distorted perspective, but you've also got to help them get there. You've got to kind of like help them with the orientation. So you've got illustrations where you're showing the external view of the entire, you know, robot setup so that they kind of see like where this stuff is positioned.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. yeah, it's a whole new area of creating visualizations, and you really kind of need somebody like a medical illustrator who is familiar with, you know, visualizing things in different ways, and who might be able to suggest we could do a cross section here, or we could do, you know, levels of transparency, you know, all the types of tricks that we have in our toolbox can really help to communicate this stuff, right?
Are they doing robotic surgery where you are?
Yes, it's something.
And are you doing videos of it?
We've just started. We're doing a few, actually. We've got recordings from a few, and so we're starting to work those up, and we'll probably do OB-GYN first and then HPB later. So yeah, we are getting into exploring it, and it's amazing. It's fascinating stuff.
Great. You've probably found where you are too, that you're becoming an indispensable jack of all trades, whatever they need that is even remotely related to anything visual or communication, like you become the one.
Hopefully. Now, I've noticed you've done a lot of really beautiful illustrations that combine a well-done portrait with an anatomical overlay. And so I was wondering if you could share maybe some tips or suggestions about how to approach these types of images, because I've always found faces to be like really challenging.
Oh yeah. Well, I love drawing faces. Like I'd do that all day if I could. Portraits and people. But I found that a big factor is the position of the head, really. Like, you know, if you are, illustrating the pineal gland or the pituitary gland, you know, and you want to show that it's inside the head. I had to do this recently, actually. How you position the head is important, because you want that area of focus inside the head that you're ghosting inside the head to be far enough away from any important facial features that it's not misinterpreted as like, you know, it's the eye, or, you know, like, so the space between the focus and the face itself needs to be enough that the viewer, and this kind of gets back to that point we were talking about earlier about visual pattern recognition and where is the eye going, and it would be a good thing to study, but you want that area of focus to be far enough away from any facial features that the viewer is not going to misinterpret.
So that's a great tip, man. That's really good.
We did a lot of things on the Mayfield Atlas, the first book, that we called Ghosted Heads. Like the first image was always a head with the important anatomy inside, like the skull, and then like whether you, the ventricles, if it was a tumor in the ventricles, and it was always, the rule of thumb was that always has to be right in front of you, because that's where the surgeon would position the head, so that where the craniotomy is going to go is going to be right closest to you. So that was the center. And however the head lined up around that, you know, was however it was. But if we put the craniotomy first and then the important anatomy ghosted through that and then lined it up so that the tumor was like kind of in the center of that craniotomy outline, that's how we would line that up. Yeah. So, and then contrast, like area, if the area of focus, this is always a tricky part, because you know, we learn that if you're drawing something that's inside something else, like you're ghosting in some anatomy, like that would be lighter because you're looking through this tissue, and that whatever on the surface would be, I don't know, darker or more detailed or more outlined or whatever. But that's tricky because really the face is just for orientation, basically, and to show the humanity of someone, which is really important. You really want the viewer to focus on your target inside the head, for example. So it takes some playing with to get the right balance. But there is this inherent tension between the recognizable features of the face with the unrecognizable, with maybe what's new to the viewer, like the focus inside the head. Like if it's a patient education piece and you're drawing that pituitary, you just want to give them enough information to show that this is a structure inside your head and it's right about here. But you don't want to over detail it, I guess. Anyway, I'm rambling, but those are some of the things that, you know, go through my head when I'm trying to do that.
For sure. Right on, man. What else can you share about your current production pipeline? You know, what are the tools you're using the most? Are there steps that you take on every single project, or like favorite techniques that you have?
Yeah. So in a place like this, where we are doing whatever anybody needs, there isn't necessarily a lot of time to noodle things, like to really make something shine. A lot of it is, you know, you've got to get it done. Time is a huge factor, both because people have publishing or grant application deadlines, and also money. The balance, as we're an earnings unit, so we're total cost recovery. We've got to charge for our time, but we have to do it. We have to do a project in an amount of time that the client can pay for. So time is always a factor. So whatever we can do as quickly as possible, we try to do. A major thing is that initial meeting when we sit down with them and we talk about the specs, ask any possible question, pin them down as much as possible. If you can draw on the screen while you're talking to them, do that. Like that's when you interviewed Andrew Swift, he talked about how when he has a client in a virtual meeting, he'll share his screen and he'll draw as they're talking. And that creates something that they walk away from the meeting with, you know, like they have an image and you've kind of nailed down the important parts of what they're looking for. So that saves a lot of time, you know, if you can do that. And our process is usually working in Illustrator and Photoshop. A lot of times we're going right to Illustrator. We're not tracing or drawing on tracing paper first or anything like that. Although I like that technique a lot. We're going right to creating lines in Illustrator, adding some local color to that vector shape, and sending that to the client to review, make sure that the anatomy is correct, the position's correct, the instruments look correct, or whatever it is. And we work that out. And then we take that into Photoshop and add highlights, textures, shadows, things like that. So it's usually Illustrator, client approval, Photoshop.
Right on. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about those initial kickoff meetings, getting like everyone on the same page, knowing what the scope is, right? You know, the intended audience, the goal of the piece, what's the communication challenge or what the pain point of this communication, like what's getting missed? Like what is the need for this thing we're creating, right?
Exactly. Yeah. One thing I want to start doing is taking those AMI salon judging sheets. I do a lot of judging for salons. There's a whole sheet that we use to evaluate each piece. And it's things like, how well does it solve the problem? How appropriate is the technique? How's the anatomy? Like that would be a good checklist when you're starting an illustration, because that's a good measure of whether it's effective or not. So like going through that checklist is a good way to start an illustration, I think, when you're planning it, when you're sketching it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a great idea. You know, what you've described here too, I would really argue, I mean, this is the kinds of ways that professionals think about taking on projects, right? It's really thinking about the effectiveness of what you're doing. It's not necessarily how cool it looks. It's not necessarily how much money I'm getting paid. It's about how effectively am I solving this problem,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, what are some of the other things that come to mind for you when you think about being a professional, and when you think about how do you get people to respect you as a creative professional and not just, you know, like an artist? You know, I mean, sometimes that term is, I think there's a lot of folks in our field who really try to move away from that term because it can have, you know, not the right connotation we want to have, right? So yeah, what would you say is the best way to get people to respect you as a professional?
Value your own time. If you value your time and you charge accordingly, then they will. So not underselling and being realistic about how much time something will take you, even if that seems like high cost, present that cost. And if they don't want to pay it, negotiate from there. So here at the university, people respect what we do, which is nice. That's one of the benefits about being a medical illustrator, I think. The doctors really appreciate the work that we do as medical illustrators because they can't do it and they need it. It's nice to create something that someone really appreciates. However, yeah, there's a lot of selling that has to happen. And I would say, have your elevator speech ready. If you're on an elevator that's going up 5 floors with the chairman of cardiology, you know, or the dean of the College of Medicine, or the CEO of the hospital, or a potential client, like what in 30 seconds would you say about the value of what you do? I have a speech that I ramble off to anybody who wants to know about what we do in our department. What does a medical illustrator do? And also, I want to add to that, like some facts from those articles, you know, like that you posted or that's on the AMI website about the value of what we do. Like if you can cite research, because that's what, you know, that's what science-minded people respond to, research and data. If you can cite some facts.
Show me the evidence.
Show me the evidence, yeah. Name the research study and the journal it was in and the conclusion, you know, like that's a real plus too for us as medical illustrators to be able to share that.
Absolutely.
If I can just digress for a minute.
No, please.
I was in Chicago over Thanksgiving and was able to connect with, through a friend of mine, the person in charge of the Health Sciences Library's Special Collections. And I got to see their Paul Peck illustration collection. When Paul Peck illustrated for Merck, I think, like he did over 500 illustrations for them. And then Merck in like 2018, I think, donated it to the UIC Health Sciences Library. John Doherty gave a talk about this, I think, in 2019 at one of the meetings. This collection, it's amazing work, but I got to actually go and open the boxes and hold the illustrations. And there are beautiful airbrush and traditional brush illustrations that are finished and complete. And even though some structures, blood vessels and nerves are very, very small, you know exactly what they are. They're done on clay-coated surface and other types of Bristol boards and things. And they're just beautiful. And I thought a lot about the value of what we do when I looked at those. And I was just amazed at the quality. Like it's definitely a level to aspire to, that illustration work.
Yeah, that guy's ability to capture light on form and not mm-hmm. just realistically, but to push it in the direction of like, pay attention here, and then be able to represent something like a large bowel so beautifully and accurately, and yet at the same time downplay the details on it just enough so that you actually look over here instead at these, because this is where the focus is, like mm-hmm. yeah mm-hmm. Paul Peck is incredible, absolutely incredible.
Yeah So I took some pictures and I'm gonna print them and put them up on my wall as an aspirational target try to reach that level. Yeah, so my point in saying that was that another way of valuing what we do is if we value it ourselves. And there's this really something I've only started thinking about recently, like how do I treat the stuff I create? Does it end up in a box somewhere in the basement? Is it crumpled up in the corner? Or do I value it? Do I put it in an acid-free archival collection box? You know, do I label it? How do I treat my digital files? What sort of a legacy will I leave behind when I'm gone? Like, if I value that my own work now, then I think it would be valued later. So I think how we treat our own work, the material stuff, the physical stuff of our own work is an indicator of how we value what we do. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. It's so funny.
Precious.
It's so funny you mentioned that, because just the other day I was thinking about my comic book collection.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I used to be like really hardcore into comics, and I was thinking about how, you know, I put them all in those bags with the boards, you know, like to preserve them over time. And I was thinking about how, like, you know, I did that for every single comic, even the ones that I just like got for like 50 cents out of like a bargain bin. But it's so funny you mentioned that, because yeah, I love that. That's something all the training programs at the universities and colleges have taken on, is preserving artwork. That's part of what they do too, right? Is they collect and they hold on to all this work and they preserve it really well. And they tend to digitize it as well too, so that they have a digital record of everything that they've got on hand.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have a great group here in the Health Sciences Library, which is what my group is part of, called the Medical Heritage Center. And they collect and celebrate and archive the history of medicine in Central Ohio. So lots of different equipment and machinery and books. In fact, they have donated to them a real 1555 copy of the Vesalius Anatomical Atlas, like the actual thing. You know, it's like, it's huge and it's thick and it's you know, it was printed in 1555. Yeah.
Yeah, they're so big, right?
Yeah.
Massive, like...
Yeah, so it's nice to look at that and like and think about the history of that book. You know, like it was written in 15, it was printed in 1555. It's crazy.
That is so nuts. Yeah, you've been an active member of the AMI for many years. I think that's where maybe we first crossed paths, where I first started to get to know you.
I think so.
I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about your experience with the AMI and where you'd like to see the AMI go in the coming years.
Yeah. I love the AMI. I mean, I haven't been as involved as I want to be. I've done some things. I plan to do more, but it's a great, intimidating organization. It can seem intimidating because you have all these amazing people who are doing such great things and exploring different areas of medical illustration, but still they carve out time to, you know, present at conferences and lead committees and become officers and on the board. It can seem very intimidating, but they're nice people. And they're friends and you get to know them. And I would encourage anybody starting out or at any level to join the AMI if they're serious about being a medical illustrator, and also to get involved because it's a great way to learn more and make connections and network, and it's very valuable. I love that we have meetings every year in different places, and I'm able here at the university to be able to go. I know it's an expense, but it's a good thing to go to. I'm totally in favor of the certification process. I think that's a great idea, and that should be, and that matters to people who aren't medical illustrators, people we work with, other professionals. To be certified is an important step, I think. So other professions have professional organizations, right? Some are bigger, some are smaller, and they all, you know, like from the outside, they all seem very professional. Like people are presenting and they're writing papers, and you don't think about them necessarily being real people, but when you're part of a professional organization doing all those things and yet you still get to know the people, it seems less scary. Like they're just real people. Does that make sense? Am I like, you know?
No, totally. Yeah. Yeah. There's so many folks that, like you mentioned, I knew them through their work. And mm-hmm. So I saw their work and I'm just like, how does a human being do this?
Right? Totally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then when you meet them in person, you're like, well, they seem so normal and like just a regular person. Like, so yeah, in a way it makes their work a little less intimidating because you're like, well, they figured it out. So I'm sure I could figure it out too, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time also, it's like, you realize that there's so many levels, right? There's like just, and also there's specialties, there's niche areas you can go into where you can just really go down a rabbit hole into like this particular method of visualization, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of it's represented in the AMI. And I love that the AMI is looking at ways to reach out to a broader community and include diversity and represent diversity in the work that we do, and also reach out to other countries. Like, you know, Levant F is doing the whole program of setting up similar groups in other countries, like in Turkey and in other places. And then, you know, I'm also a member of the European Association of Medical Illustrators.
Oh, awesome.
There are a couple of other AMIRs who are doing that too. But like, I'm all in favor of connecting with people around the world who do what we do and building a much broader network of connection with other medical illustrators. And I think through the AMI, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that in this case, sometimes I think maybe like folks get a little concerned that like, oh man, there's going to be so much more competition, you know, from overseas and whatnot. But I think actually, if you think about it more from a growth mindset as opposed to a scarcity mindset, you know, these are kind of like some of the LinkedIn posts that like motivational posts and stuff, right? But I kind of like that stuff. I like the motivational, you know, self-help kind of philosophies. And I do think that there's something to that. I think if you think in terms of, well, the more we connect with folks from other countries and from other parts of the world, the more that we make what we do accessible for them, and the more we make training more accessible, the more we make membership and organizations more accessible, the more connections we make with other people, and the more opportunities crop up, the more ideas come forth, right? And it's going to grow the field. That's usually what happens when you connect with people outside of your bubble, it expands, right? And the positive aspects get enhanced.
Yep, totally agree. Yep.
So I think we're definitely going to see more of it, and it's a good thing, and we're moving in the right direction in that respect for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It all seems very positive. The future seems bright, I think, for what we do. I'm not worried that the need for us will disappear anytime soon. And the more we can celebrate the people who are doing different things with their medical illustration training, There are just too many to mention right now, but we could spend a long time talking about the ways people are branching out into other areas that just makes us stronger and better as a group, as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of your thoughts about what you see happening in the future, maybe the next 5 to 10 years in the field of medical illustrations? What kinds of things have you sort of like caught wind of?
So here at OSU, we've started something called the EdTech Incubator, which is showcasing different ways that technology can be used in education, medical education specifically here. Like it's a space, and it's right here on the fourth floor where my office is. It includes like a 3D printing lab and an anatomy visualization space, you know, with virtual reality headsets, and you can, you know, see the cadaver before you and remove pieces and see anatomy underneath. And also a big screen that has 3D cadaver on it, and you can rotate and move anatomy and learn that way. It has VR simulation space. It has a high-tech classroom with new technology for teaching. It has a studio for recording, you know, podcasts and lectures and things. It's very new. There's a collaborative space. They're really looking at ways that they can use technology in education to better teach our students. And I think there are a lot of ways that my group can participate in that. Since we're the visualization experts, right? We can help create the things that help students learn. So I'm hoping for a lot more collaboration with the EdTech Incubator and its continued growth and success here at Ohio State. Yeah, technology, I think, is big. So here in my department, we need to get into what you're doing all the time, you know, the animation and the 3D stuff. We're learning Maya, Cinema 4D, and those software. That's an area we need to grow into. I have a wonderful younger medical illustrator working with me here, Courtney Fleming, who's a graduate of Cleveland Institute of Art Biomedical Visualization Program with Tom Nowacki. And she's worked out great. She's been wonderful. And she's younger, like she's so much younger, and just jumps into these things right away and has a much stronger, I don't know, a better ability to just, you know, do them, right? So that's an area we're going to grow into more here because we really need to. And one of my goals then in the new year is to really survey our top clients and the people we do a lot of work with here and find out what do they need from a department like mine. Like, do they need us just keep drawing pictures for them? Do they need us to work with them to create animations? Do they need us to help them in their research in areas that require visualization or thinking outside the box, things like that? Like, I really want to explore other ways that a small group like mine, because there are just three of us, can really help the researchers and the faculty and the scientists here at Ohio State. So. And then what do we need to learn in order to be able to provide those services to them? And so I think that's going to mean a lot of jumping into some technology that I'm on the surface a little uncomfortable with at first, but I'll get there.
No, for sure, man. I totally feel you. And I think one of the things I've been trying to do and I would like to push more of is to teach the video editing software that we use. So we were using Adobe Premiere Pro for many years. And in the past few years, we've almost completely converted over to DaVinci Resolve, which is a free video editing software that is so powerful. It's insane. I mean, it's basically like what Blender is for 3D animation. That's what DaVinci Resolve is for video.
Okay.
Yeah, it's incredible. And so I've been doing a couple tutorials on our TVA Surge blog, and I've got a webinar that I'm going to be doing with the AMI coming up.
Oh, good. I'm going to take that.
It's going to be specifically about how to composite your 3D renders in DaVinci Resolve, because it has a node-based compositing feature in there. So you can totally bypass After Effects and just do all your compositing in this software.
So
video, interestingly, I think this is something that basically everyone in our field can start jumping into and doing, because what I notice is that there's a lot of these fitness folks, like CrossFit people and stuff, who are just grabbing medical illustrations off Google and they're just making all these like fitness training videos, but they're just using the images to like make a quick point about like, it's this muscle, this is the one we're going to hit in this exercise, right? And so like, I can understand why they don't have any qualms about just like grabbing an image, throwing it in their video. And like they don't even think twice about like trying to contact the person or pay a licensing fee. Cause they're just like, no, I'm just making one little point real quickly here. I don't know how often they get like people chasing after them or anything like that, but it makes me think about like the people we work with and like what they are asking for in presentations. And you hear this all the time. Well, I just need it for this, or like, well, I just need to do this one little slide. And like, people don't see the reason to pay for, you know, a licensing fee to use just one illustration on one slide of an otherwise 150 long slide long PowerPoint. And it's like, I kind of see where they're coming from, but I also think that there's a case to be made where like, okay, you want to use our video or our illustration in your PowerPoint, like just hire us to make your whole PowerPoint.
Yeah.
You know? And then we can just, we'll pull stuff from our library, but at the same time, we can record the whole thing for you. We can record your audio at high quality. We can record your video at high quality. We can composite all that stuff together for you. We can, and not only that, we can make and manage your social media account for you if you want to, right? So upsell, you know, take the opportunity to like, you know, turn it around.
Yeah. So it requires what we know we can do, but it's for a totally different audience and a different kind of purpose, but still requires the level of knowledge that we have.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And there's so many things we can do that they don't know we can do, you know, like when you've got an archive of all these Photoshopped anatomical illustration pieces, they don't know that we could separate out organs. They don't know that we had those on different layers, you know, like they don't know that we can do all this other cool stuff with like simple animations. Like there's stuff you can do animating inside of Photoshop where you never even need to leave Photoshop.
Wow. Do you see yourself running your own company someday? Like,
oh, I don't know. I don't know. But to be honest, I don't know if I'm qualified to do that, because like that, I lean on my coworkers a lot for like technical expertise and like an extra set of eyes. One thing I find, anytime I'm working on a project that's not for work, I'm constantly showing it to my wife to get her feedback. You know, so I always need, you know, I think it's indispensable to have some feedback coming on whatever it is you're making, because you get so into what you're doing and you get so excited about like the tricks and the techniques you're using that you forget that, like, you know, your audience has to receive this a certain way, and you know, you need to see it from a pair of eyes that aren't also making it, I think.
Yeah, totally. Yep. In fact, I want to set up here a group of people, like general public people, to look at our patient education medical illustrations to make sure that they can understand what's going on. Because we can draw something and think it's great, but if they don't get what they're looking at, then it's pointless. I know they have teams of people here that look at the text to make sure it's at the right reading level and it conveys the ideas, and they review it. But I don't know that there's the same thing for the visuals. Yeah, because that's a good point. People, your viewer needs to understand what it is, or else it's you know, it's kind of pointless.
Yeah. Now, do you have any like favorite books or resources that you use to keep learning and keep yourself, or do you like have any favorite books about visualization?
I do. Do I have it here? Let's see. There are many that have come out of Team Up Publishing that I really like, like this General Anatomy and Musculoskeletal System. I think they're German illustrators. I don't know who exactly, but they're just beautiful and lots of good information and very helpful. I like the Edward Tufte books about, you know, designing information. Those are really fun, really helpful too.
Amazing. All right, cool. Yeah, I'll have to hunt that down. Amazing. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to promote, or anyone you want to give shout out to, or any final thoughts?
On the AMI Hub, there's a community called Medical Illustrators in Healthcare Education Settings. And we're going to have a Zoom meeting for anybody in that field who wants to share ideas and bounce ideas and talk about what they're doing. So if you want to join, go to the AMI Hub and get the information or send me an email. I'll send you the Zoom information.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, Tony.
I enjoyed it. It was great to chat with you, and I look forward to seeing you again.
And a big thanks to you as well, dear listener. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Anthony Baker, and hopefully it's shed some light on the work of medical illustrators in medical education and healthcare. As mentioned, Anthony is an active member of the AMI, and he started a focus group for medical illustrators in medical education and healthcare, which will have virtual get-togethers on a recurring basis. If you're interested in joining the next meetup, feel free to shoot me an email or a message on social media, and I'll pass along the details. Keep an eye out for more episodes coming soon. I'm really excited about what's coming up this year and putting out more episodes of the podcast. In the meantime, I hope you're maintaining a healthy work-life balance, producing content that you feel good about, and staying connected with people who give you positive energy. So, until next time, be well, my friends.